City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Oh, I like that.
I'm Steven Rader.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This program is brought to you in part by Broadway in Chicago. For the hottest tickets in town, visit BroadwayInChicago.com. And American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
And you're listening to the Windy City Queer Cast, show number 339. I'm Amy Matheny.
And I'm Steven Rader.
You are wow. Steven Rader. We're Skyping.
We're Skype just like Oprah.
Just like Oprah.
Just like the big O.
Like gay men having sex everywhere. With the Skype. Do you think Oprah's ever going to do this segment where it's like, gay men who were having sex on Skype before I knew what Skype was?
I don't think she even talks to Stedman anymore, so I don't think that will happen at all.
Maybe it could be Stedman explains to Oprah the many uses of Skype on today's Oprah.
Oh my God, have you seen last week's soup where she's eating a corn dog in Texas?
She went to the Texas Fair.
Oh, my God. And Joel McHale says she's totally going to Stedman that corn dog. I thought it was brilliant. I want that man.
Oh,
I want that man.
God. How my funny goodness. Is that? How are what you?
I'm crazy and tired and good and all that good stuff.
You're heading into the season for Season of Concern.
Very, very much so.
Your Season of Concern, the organization which you are a director of, usually does what during December with all the Chicago theaters?
Well, we just sort of work with everybody who's having a show, doing a performance or whatnot. And if they would like to, they can collect money, or after a show's over, they can have a special benefit performance for us or whatnot. But a lot of that happens between Thanksgiving and New Year's, really.
Yeah.
But a lot of what we bring in every year happens at about a month and a week.
Wow.
So it's fun to prepare for that. Oh, yeah, it's fun. It's
very wow. fun. Well, there's so many great holiday shows, so...
Oh, yeah.
I would imagine that this is
how
a really...
How many Christmas carols can we have in this city?
I don't know. And then Jim Carrey has to do one on the film as well.
I know.
They're
like
everywhere.
Nutballs. How many do we have? It's way too many to think about.
I wonder if a Christmas carol is like the most... probably the birth of Christ. The Nativity story and this story are the most filmed, televised, staged... show story ever, don't you think? What other stories?
That and John and Kate plus eight, I'm pretty sure.
No, but it's really interesting. I've never thought about it, but I bet it's one of the most told stories.
Oh, yeah, easily.
Who would have thought? Chucky D.
Wasn't that the 20th century's most sung song was Happy Birthday?
Yeah. Right? Yeah, I think so.
See how boring we are. It sounds like so boring, doesn't it?
I love the Christmas Carol, though. I do love the Christmas
you do.
Carol. I do.
No, the Goodman's Christmas Carol is excellent.
Yeah, beautiful.
It's really excellent.
What's your favorite version of Christmas Carol?
How do you mean?
My favorite is Scrooged. If I don't see Scrooged every December, I am sad. I love it so freaking much. I have no idea why I love it, but I love it. I love that it has Bill Murray and Carole King and Mary Lou Retton all in a 2-hour little tasty morsel.
Now, with did you say an Annie Lennox King song. Or Carole Kane?
Carole Kane. Oh, okay. It could have Carole King too. I probably did say Carole King. I was thinking of the fact that Annie Lennox, doesn't Annie Lennox do the little song?
I can't remember what
the song is. It's just packed full of good little morsels of the 80s and early 90s. I love it.
But your people are obviously not as redneck as my people are.
Oh.
Because you know, Daddy watches, you know, it doesn't matter. At the end of whatever we're doing on Christmas Eve night, we have to watch Christmas Vacation. We have to.
Yeah.
We just have to.
Yeah.
Just for the line, the shitter was full. And that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. Ben's over laughing, can't handle it. You know, usually the wine is spilled. There's lots of fun.
You've been going to see some theater. I hear that you and Mitchell Fain had a little night out on the town going to see Young Frankenstein.
Oh, sure did. Yeah, we saw Young Frankenstein. It was, you know, I've told everybody it's not producers.
Right.
You know, but it's still a nice show. It's just not, it doesn't all come together like the producers did. You know, producers really was wonderful right out of the gate.
Do you think it's trying to be too big? And if it was really like some late night show in Chicago that was being done in a basement or at midnight, that
we'd give it a chance?
It would, yeah. It would kind of be in the spirit of what it is.
I think that what I thought the problem was that when the producers, you're doing a parody of musicals by doing a musical that is in that genre. It's really written as a 30s, you know, ABA kind of song show, mm-hmm. which is also making fun of that kind of musical at the same time. And it worked because it's about making a musical.
Right.
This is not about that at all. It's about these 30s, you know, Universal horror films. And the same kind of style doesn't necessarily work. And I don't know that we're getting anything new.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you know, a lot of the putting on the Ritz number is great.
Mm-hmm.
Other things, the woman who plays Frau Mutter is just damn hilarious. Hilarious. And as is the guy who plays Igor. Just great. Just wonderful performances. But the bar is set way high after the producer.
Yeah, it's
way
true.
Way too high.
It's true.
I loved him.
I have to say something else that the bar was set way too high for me on this week.
Uh-oh.
Was the Wanda Sykes show that premiered this past weekend.
Oh, really? I didn't see it.
It was, like, painfully bad. It will be all over the soup, I am sure, and you will have to tell me what they say, because I'll probably miss it. But I was giving her shout-outs. Her special on HBO is hilarious.
Hilarious. Brilliant.
Brilliantly funny. She, this proves, once again, how hard it is to be a talk show host or an interviewer or somebody who does what it is you and I are doing right now. It's not just something that you can go, you know what, I want to sit and talk to people. Because she was not good, and she did not lean into any of her strengths, and there were moments that were downright so painful and uncomfortable. And, you know, she has this segment where she invites some people, and she had, like, the girl from The Office and the guy who hosts Amazing Race and another guy, I can't remember, a comedian, African-American comedian guy, actor. And they have cocktails, and that's when they're supposed to sit and dish. Well, it ain't The View. None of us are drinking while we're watching you drink. It was just not. Or maybe if we were drinking, it would have been a tiny bit less painful, but it wouldn't have been any funnier or engaging.
Oh,
it was just
honey.
Not good. So, folks, if you watched it,
is it during the day?
Please post a comment. No, it's at night. It's on Fox. She did a whole segment where she's walking around getting a dildo. I was like, are you kidding me? Oh, yeah, she had it like, I'm sure they've never seen that on Fox talk show host at 10.
Well,
it just didn't
not
work for me. No.
Oh,
it just
honey.
Did not work. Did not work.
If you're not
with a drag queen, with a drag queen doing the like politically incorrect questionnaire.
God.
Oh, it was just not good. It was so not good.
God bless her heart.
I'm so sad for her because she's, you know, Miss Cleo and I talked a lot about her. I was really excited about this. And not good. Maybe we can still hold out hope. Maybe somebody got like a tourniquet on that stat because it's once a week. But and it's,
but, you know, I feel like I'm the asshole when it comes to her and everybody else that, you know, after gay marriage was, you know, all of a sudden now they're out of the closet. Where the fuck have you been?
Yeah.
Where the hell have you been? I'm that asshole who thinks that all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
I know.
I'm so sick of that. But
I know.
Because you and I were out when we were four.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, no. I was out with boys till I was more than 14, but...
Well, you know, I
you
I
were out
jewelry.
At four.
I was. I was born 26, and I just said, let's start.
Well, there
let's
you go.
let's
well,
begin.
Well, it's true. It's true. And I think she's, you know, having her moment, but as somebody said, perhaps why she plays such a great sidekick is that she's not the main character. Like, she can hold it on her own with her stand-up, but... You know, she needs to be the person butting the jokes, not the person leading the conversation and hoping other people will be funny with her, because it did not work at all.
You have to know who you are.
You do.
You have to know who you are.
You do.
I tell you, if you're not watching Craig Ferguson, you're just not watching television right now.
I love Craig Ferguson.
Craig Ferguson is freaking brilliant with that.
Yeah.
It's like the puppets he uses every day. Oh, my God.
Yep.
Crazy. It has nothing to do with the fact that there's a very attractive young boy who's in a harness and leather shorts. Nothing to do with that.
Nothing to do with that.
Nothing at all.
The face of late night television is changing. That's all we can say.
Yes. Oh, I'm just saying it's like IML every weeknight. I love it.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm going to start setting him in my TiVo then. Hey, folks. Now, I know many of you are reality television fans, and really, one of the first reality TV stars was this woman who was called the Tone Deaf Diva. Her name was Floris Foster Jenkins, and there is a new play with music being done up at Northlight Theater here in Chicago, and it's also played in other cities in the U.S., not this particular production, but the play has been performed. And we're going to sit down and learn a little bit about this woman that I discovered in 1990, I believe, was the first time I heard her sing Queen of the Night. And she became a superstar before we had internet, before we had reality television, before we had E! Or any of these things where a Susan Boyle could rise to the top. Florence Foster Jenkins really set the bar and did it all without the World Wide Web. So
she reminds me, I think, a little bit of Mrs. Miller. Am I right about that? Remember Mrs. Miller?
Yes. No. Who's,
you know,
Mrs. Miller?
Oh, just go on YouTube and type in Mrs. Miller and you'll have a field day.
There
it's
you
the
go.
Kind, the kind of thing in the 60s. It's really hilarious.
Yeah, well, Florence was doing this back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you know, and sold out Carnegie Hall. It's an incredible story. And Steve Scott, the director of Souvenir, which is the play about her life or inspired by her life, is going to be on the show today. Plus, we've got a lot of news, what's going on in the theater scene, and Richard Knight Jr. giving us his look at this second week of the GLBT Film Festival here in Chicago, Reeling 2009. So, Stephen, I'll be back after this.
Hi, I'm a Miller Lite Brewmaster.
Yeah, and I'm a Miller Lite Drinkmaster.
It's the Brewmaster Drinkmaster Show.
I just created a revolutionary aluminum pint bottle. Great new way to enjoy the taste of Miller Lite.
Wow. See, I just designed a new game day delicacy to be enjoyed with your great tasting beer, the 8-layer dip.
Well, the aluminum pint has a wider mouth, giving every sip a superior flow that delivers the great taste.
That's terrific. Most people flow from beef to bean to sour cream to cheese to guacamole to salsa to veggies. See, I'm not most people, though. I flow all the way to jambalaya.
Also, it's got a resealable cap that makes sure every sip tastes as fresh as the first.
Well, my dip is so hearty, it can last from a day game to a night game.
This isn't a competition, you know.
Okay, fine. You advance the science of drinking great-tasting beer, and I advance the art of enjoying it.
Introducing the new aluminum pint bottle from Miller Lite. Just another way for you to enjoy the great taste. Miller Lite. Great taste, less filling. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Live responsibly.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is The Week in News. Gays lost marriage in Maine on November 3rd. A people's veto at the ballot box wiped out the law passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. It had not taken effect pending the outcome of the vote. It was the 31st time that same-sex marriage has lost at the ballot box in a U.S. state. Results will be certified around November 23rd.
Kalamazoo, Michigan passed Ordinance 1856, which alters the city's non-discrimination law to include GLBT individuals, legally protecting them from discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations. The ordinance protects on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity.
A New York City taxi driver reportedly kicked a gay couple out of his cab when they embraced in the back of the vehicle. Bruno and his partner hailed a cab November 2nd, but driver Medhat Mohammed allegedly pulled the taxi over two blocks into the trip, reportedly saying, "You guys have to get out of the taxi. Hugging is not allowed in here." The Taxi and Limousine Commission is allegedly investigating the matter.
Houston lesbian city controller Annis Parker is facing a December 12th runoff to become mayor of the nation's fourth largest city. Parker will face city attorney Jean Locke, a former civil rights activist who is aiming to become the city's second black mayor. Parker was on city council for 6 years and has been the controller for the last five. Before working for Houston, she spent two decades in the oil and gas industry.
In Maplewood, Minnesota, openly gay James Yannis won a seat on the city council November 3rd despite an apparent hate mail campaign against him. Yannis worked for McHenry, Illinois-based Follett Software as a district sales consultant.
Salt Lake City now has its first out gay council member. Utah AIDS Foundation Director Stan Penfold defeated Phil Carroll to represent District 3. In recent years, Salt Lake City has also elected three out state lawmakers.
In Philadelphia, the FBI and local authorities have arrested Michael Daniels, 26, for impersonating a police officer. Four men reported to police that they were threatened by a man who claimed to be a cop after they had posted ads for male sex partners on the website Craigslist. Daniels allegedly told the men that, unless they paid him, he would arrest them for solicitation with a minor because they did not verify that he was over 18. A preliminary hearing will take place November 16th.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court rejected a lawsuit brought by anti-gay group Wisconsin Family Action. The group sought to overturn newly established domestic partner protections for gay couples and their families.
Austin, Texas has extended COBRA-like benefits to same-sex domestic partners of city employees. COBRA allows workers and their families who lose their health benefits the right to choose health benefits on a temporary basis.
In Tampa, Florida, the city council unanimously voted to give preliminary approval to expanding its human rights ordinance to protect transgender individuals from discrimination. However, controversy developed when some council members wondered if the ordinance also protected crossdressers.
In world news, in Taiwan, thousands marched through the city of Taipei to demand same-sex marriage and equal rights. Approximately 25,000 people attend the island's 7th annual Gay Pride Parade, which attracted individuals from several Asian countries.
France is condemning an anti-gay measure that Ugandan lawmakers are considering. In addition, several U.S. legislators have written to U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about the ramifications the law would have for gay people. According to the bill, those convicted of having same-sex relations with disabled people and minors would face the death penalty.
Tasmania's Legislative Council is now legally recognizing lesbian mothers who are not biological parents of their children. Non-biological mothers will now be listed as parents on their children's birth certificates instead of having to go through adoption procedures.
And in entertainment news, on the TV show 90210, a same-sex relationship will soon take place, and one of the lovers is Demi Moore's daughter, Rumor Willis. Jessica Lowndes, who plays previously straight Adriana, will embark on a relationship with fellow student Gia, played by Willis.
Adam Lambert is back on the market. The American Idol runner-up has broken up with his boyfriend, interior designer Drake LeBry. Lambert's debut CD, For Your Entertainment, will be available November 23rd.
Gay icon Sir Elton John was recently hospitalized. John, 62, was being treated for flu complications. The singer was reportedly in London's King Edward II Hospital in London with his partner David Furnish at his side.
Actress Rue McClanahan of TV's Maude and Golden Girls has been hospitalized, leading to the cancellation of a San Francisco event honoring her. McClanahan, who is 75, was to be saluted at the November 14th event Golden, a gala tribute to Rue McClanahan, but has been ordered to stay in bed because of a heart ailment.
After a long campaign to appear on Oprah's magazine cover, the December issue of O Magazine features Ellen DeGeneres with Oprah Winfrey. Ellen appeared on Oprah on Monday to discuss American Idol, her marriage, and more. Portia de Rossi, her wife, joined her for their first ever televised interview.
Film director Paul Haggis of Crash and Million Dollar Baby fame has left the Church of Scientology because of a chapter's support of the anti-same-sex marriage initiative, Proposition 8. In a letter, Haggis wrote that he had tried to persuade the church to condemn its San Diego branch for supporting Prop 8. He also wrote, "The church's refusal to denounce the action of these bigots, hypocrites, and homophobes is cowardly. I can think of no other word. Silence is consent, Tommy. I refuse to consent." And that's the weekend news brought to you by Windy City Times.
Hey everyone, this is Richard Knight Jr., film critic for Windy City Times and at the movies, with a little overview of the second week of Reeling, Chicago's Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, now in its 28th year. We're second oldest in the nation. Richard Gnung, star of the classic gay movie Parting Glances and the Sean Hayes comedic vehicle Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss, queer eyes for the straight guys Jay Rodriguez and a host of behind-the-camera LGBT filmmakers are going to be here for the second week of Reeling. Some second-week highlights include the Thursday, November 12th screening of the endearing Swedish dramedy Patrick Age 1.5, in which gay couple Goran and Sven decide to adopt a baby to round out their new suburban life. But unfortunately, a typo brings them a 15-year-old juvenile delinquent who's a homophobe instead. It's subtitled and very charming. Laura Harring, star of David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, or if it's Herring, I think it's, I can't tell you which, headlines the lesbian black comedy Drool. She plays a harried housewife subjected to abuse by her racist husband and lots of disrespect from teenage kids. Then her friendship with her new African-American neighbor, Imogene, played by Jill Marie Jones of TV's Girlfriends, blossoms into something more until the husband walks in discovering the romance, when, of course, all hell breaks loose, Thelma and Louise style, with darkly comedic results. That screens on November 14th, Friday. ZMD, Zombies of Mass Destruction, also screens that night. Well, sooner or later, a queer addition to the killer zombie genre had to arrive, and ZMD, a horror comedy, cleverly billed as a political zombie in the tradition of the Evil Dead pictures, is a great fun. Prepare yourself for lots and lots of gross-out gore and plenty of tongue-in-cheek dialogue a la Shaun of the Dead. The Queer Film Society, the film group that I started with my fellow queer film critics, most who can speak more speak better than I can. The group that we started last spring is going to co-host with Reeling a free panel discussion on the state of queer cinema, past, present, and future, on Saturday, November 14th at 3 p.m. at Columbia College's Film Center. Look it up. The panel, which is titled New Queer Cinema, which I just said, will be moderated by Time Out film critic Hank Sarton and includes a bevy of queer film critics, including myself, and Fish Out of Water documentary filmmaker Kai Dickens, and perhaps most pertinent to the topic, out actor Richard Gnung, star of the aforementioned queer cinema classic Parting Glances and Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss. The panel will include audience members in discussing the in the discussion. Man, I'm really having trouble today. Richard Gnung will stick around for a screen of Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss at 5 p.m. following the panel and another Q&A with the audience. Also a presentation of Reeling and the Queer Film Society. This is a rare opportunity to see out director Tommy O'Haver's 1998 charming romantic comedy on the big screen. Also screening on Saturday, November 14th is Rivers Wash Over Me, Reeling's dramatic centerpiece film, which focuses on a New Yorker, young African-American guy named Saquon Green, who, after the death of his mother, has to go live with relatives in backwoods Alabama. To say that Saquon has trouble adapting is putting it mildly in this entertaining melodrama highlighted by the performance of Derek L. Middleton in the leading role. Then the festival ends, finally, on Sunday, November 15th, with a 7:30 p.m. screening at the Music Box with the aforementioned, here's now, Oy Vey, My Son is Gay, which is the latest in a long line of ethnic-based comedies in which a closeted gay must finally come out to a stunned but eventually supportive family. Think Mambo, Italiano, The Wedding Banquet, etc. Film is greatly aided by its willing cast, headed by Lainey Kazan, yes, legendary Lainey, Saul Rubinek, Bruce Vilanch playing straight as the wacky uncle, Carmen Electra, believe it or not, Vincent Pastore from The Sopranos, and the aforementioned, yes, I did aforemention him, Jade Rodriguez from Queer Eye for the Straight Guy as a frustrated boyfriend. The director and Rodriguez will both attend the screening and festive after party at Architectural Artifacts. There are many, many other second week films, short and long, worth checking out. I will not mention any more, I promise. Complete festival information, tickets, theaters, locations, times, etc., etc., are available by calling 773-293-1447 or go to www.reelingfilmfestival.org.
The new Mel Brooks musical, Young Frankenstein, is alive and headed here. The record-breaking team behind the producers delivers all your favorite moments from the classic film, plus brand new show-stopping numbers including Transylvania Mania. The New York Post calls it Broadway at its dizziest, glitziest, and funniest. Don't miss the screamingly funny Young Frankenstein, directed by Susan Stroman.
Now playing through December 13th at the Cadillac Palace Theater. For tickets, call 800-775-2000 or visit BroadwayInChicago.com.
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club. Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Queer.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of November 9th, 2009, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. Court Theater presents The Mystery of Irma Vep, written by Charles Ludlam. Vep satirizes all that is ridiculous in gothic horror, classic film, and conventional theater, and it's also a contender for the funniest American play of the last quarter century. Get tickets for Irma Vep at courttheater.org.
Meet Florence Foster Jenkins in Souvenir, the uproarious story inspired by the tone-deaf diva socialite destined for Carnegie Hall. A touching and comic tribute to Ms. Jenkins' sincerity, ambition, and complete lack of talent. Souvenir chronicles her unlikely journey from laughingstock to musical legend, playing at Northlight Theater through December 20th. For more on Souvenir, visit northlight.org.
Writers Theater presents Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, directed by artistic director Michael Halberstam. Hamlet, Shakespeare's greatest drama, is retold from the perspective of his schoolmates. Experience the original breakout hit from four-time Tony Award winner Tom Stoppard. Tickets are selling quickly. Order yours today by logging on to writerstheater.org.
You met him as George Gershwin in George Gershwin Alone, then as Frederick Chopin. Now Hershey Felder returns to Chicago as the greatest composer of them all, Ludwig von Beethoven in Beethoven As I Knew Him, featuring some of the composer's most well-known works. Don't miss Beethoven As I Knew Him, playing November 13th through December 20th at Drury Lane Water Tower Place. For tickets, visit Ticketmaster.com.
Victory Gardens Fresh Squeezed presents Terry Galloway's Out All Night and Lost My Shoes as part of the 2009-2010 Queer Icon Series. One night only, Monday, November 15th at 7:30 p.m., Galloway delivers 1 hour of pure energetic theater that's just a little scary, like eating snails or doing oral sex for the first time, says Time Out London. Don't miss it. Visit victorygardens.org for more information. And for more Culture Club, visit WhitneyCityTimes.com.
Hi, this is Sandra Bernhard, and you're listening to me on Windy City Queer Cast. Cast your net wide, and who knows what you'll come up with.
Ooh, there's tears and there's fears and there's losses and crosses to bear. And sometimes the best we can do is just to whisper.
Press on because there's so much to live for and so much to love in this beautiful world. Say what you will, but I still believe it's a beautiful world. It's a beautiful world.
Florence Foster Jenkins, Who was she? Well, she was a reality idol long before American Idol or reality television or Star Search. She was definitely a star of her own making. A new play explores the life and music of the tone-deaf diva who rose to fame in the 20s and 30s and even sang Carnegie Hall right before her death. Souvenir is the play that gives us a glimpse of what her life might have been, and the acclaimed Chicago director Steve Scott, who is also the associate producer at the Goodman Theater, is the perfect man to bring Souvenir to life up in Skokie at the North Light Theater here in Chicago for those of us who can get to see this production in Chicago. And I'm so excited about this show. Steve, it's so great to have you on the Queercast.
Well, thank you. It's great to be able to talk to you about this. It's a great show.
Well, you know, it's a great story. I remember, I mean, my background's in musical theater, and I was doing my first summer of summer stock out in Utah. And I remember our musical director bringing in this cassette tape, so I'm dating myself, and brought in this cassette tape of this woman singing Queen of the Night. And I remember us just kind of drinking our hot tea one morning and listening to her before we started doing our warm-ups and laughing and just being astonished and baffled and captivated. Florence Foster Jenkins was the woman on that cassette. What is her story? What is her background? Where was she from? Let's start there.
Well, she grew up in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And her father was very rich and successful. And as a child, she studied the piano and was actually considered something of a prodigy on the piano. But in her teen years, she suffered an injury to her hand and could no longer play. So she switched to studying voice. Unfortunately, she wasn't a prodigy in voice. She was rather tone deaf. She had problems keeping rhythm, unfortunately. But she was so passionate about it that she decided to try to launch a career. In the middle of all of this, she married Mr. Jenkins, a marriage that lasted only a very short while. But because of that marriage, her father disinherited her for a time. And she ended up making a living giving piano lessons in Wilkes-Barre. And she was actually rather poor for a while. Then when her father died, her mother kind of brought her back into the fold. And for the rest of her life, she used her inherited wealth to do good, but also to promote her own career. She kind of started these recitals that she did as part of her work with various clubs in New York City, where she moved after her father's death. And these clubs basically were charity clubs or charitable organizations that did events to raise money. And she would plan events basically around her singing, some of the great repertoire in European opera. So she kind of started really as a do-gooder in some ways, and then became kind of a cult figure through those concerts.
Now, do you think that it is, you said she became a cult figure, and that's probably right. You know, we don't even call these people cult figures now today television.
No. well, on television, you know, they get such exposure now, but she was kind of underground for a while, and she mostly performed for her friends, but slowly word got out about, you know, the kind of phenomenon of her performance, and other people began to come in and see her. And so she did develop something of a following as she was doing this.
Now, who coined the phrase the tone-deaf diva?
I believe that was a critic. And actually, the critics were surprisingly kind to her, at least early in her career. You know, the press was much different back then. And since Florence was a member of the upper class, the press tended to treat her with kid gloves. Mm. But every once in a while, a reviewer would kind of lay his hands on her and kind of tell the truth about what he thought he'd seen anyway. Mm-hmm. And so she was called, you know, the worst singer in the world, the tone deaf diva. There were a number of titles that the press assigned to her through her career. But what was lovely about her, and I think what the play is about, is that she had such passion for what she did that she really, in some ways, rose above being just a comic figure or a kind of an oddity, because that passion really kind of informed everything that she did, and she really was truly dedicated to her art, no matter how bad she might have been.
Yeah. Do you think that it is that kind of I'm all in spirit that people connected with? Because it's almost too easy to just say people were just making fun of her. Well, I mean, people don't just, you know.
Well, no. I mean, if she had just been a joke, I think her fame would have died pretty quickly, and we certainly wouldn't be talking about her today.
Right.
It certainly was. She was pretty funny to listen to,
and
there are lots of stories about what audiences did to try to hide their laughter. You know, people would spontaneously start applauding to cover their own laughter, and people would stuff handkerchiefs in their mouth to keep from choking from laughter and all that sort of stuff. But there was something so dear about her and so kind of innocent about her in many ways that I think that was as compelling as the fact that she really wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a line in the show where her music director, and the show is basically about her relationship with her longtime accompanist, basically says, you know, basically we are, the voice that comes out is what we hear in our heads, not what other people hear. And Florence thought she was brilliant. And I think that kind of confidence and that kind of innocence is what was so compelling about her.
So she wasn't in on the, you know, we can watch, and I mean, I continue to compare her to the reality stars of today, because it's really, you know, it's a really good comparison in some ways.
It is. It's a very good comparison.
Because back then, that was very unique. Nowadays, it's a dime a dozen. But we always feel like today that, I mean, gosh, is Kate Gosselin in on the joke? I mean, she knows she's a joke. She has to, or does she? Or the Desperate Housewife of here? Or, you know, that it becomes almost an act upon an act of, I'm supposed to play this role. I'm getting the sense from you that, like, there was an authenticity from Florence, just from that quote that you said, that did not make her in on what she was being cast as, I guess.
No. I mean, the question which is posed several times through the course of the play, as Cosme, her accompanist, is talking to us, is how could she not know? Couldn't she recognize that she was that she was bad at this? And I think, at the end of the day, the fact is that she really didn't. She thought she was wonderful, and she thought that she was a true artist, and that any kind of variation in tone or rhythm or whatever came from her own spirit, not from her inability to sing well. And that's what's so kind of charming and so kind of mystifying, because most of us, I think, have a better sense, or at least a more conscious sense of how we come across to other people.
So you mentioned this confidant, this long-term accompanist, who, tell us about him and who he was in her life.
Oh, well, he was, he worked with her for years and years. He worked with her for about a dozen years. His name was Cosme McMoon. And that was actually his name, which sounds made up. And he was—he had come to New York to be a composer, but, you know, had not done terribly well in that sphere, and so was reduced to accompanying dance classes and giving voice lessons. And met Florence through a family connection that she had, and became her accompanist, as I say, for about a dozen years. And I think he, in many ways, is the central character of the show, because you know, we see Florence in performance and we see Florence as her career grows, but we also see how he responds to that. And in one way, he recognized how bad she was.
Right.
And he recognized that linking his career to hers was probably not the wisest thing to do in terms of professional advancement. On the other hand, he grew to have such an attachment with her and grew so protective of her that he stayed with her, and they basically formed this kind of little bubble in which they both existed.
Mm.
He continued composing, but again, continually without success. And I think what he really admired was that thing that we've been talking about, was the fact that she had so much the courage of her convictions, which he never really had. And so he admired that. He was jealous of it. He was frustrated by her and her inability to improve. But at the same time, he really loved her. And they formed this very, very close alliance, at least in the eyes of Stephen Temperley, who wrote the play Souvenir.
Was he a gay man?
Yes, he was. And mm-hmm. he talks about that in the play, that one of the problems that he has, he mentions several relationships, none of which last for very long.
Mm-hmm.
One gets, you know, and this was a time in the 30s and 40s when being a gay man, even in a place like New York, wasn't an easy thing.
Right.
And so his personal life was kind of sub rosa. I mean, Florence was kind of gleefully ignorant of what he was doing, but he really hid it from her as much mm-hmm. as he could. So it was an era before he could be kind of open about any of that stuff, and I think that added to the pain of his personal life, and that made his association with her even more compelling.
Right.
Because eventually she was the only one who really valued him and loved him. And so it was a very sweet little relationship that they formed, which ended tragically in 1944, when she died suddenly after her Carnegie Hall concert.
Talk to me about Carnegie Hall. I mean, obviously she had multiple recordings.
She recorded a number of her most famous arias.
Which were, give us some ideas of some of the...
Oh, well, Queen of the Night,
yes.
Which you mentioned, is probably her most famous, and it's one of the most difficult ones in all of operatic repertoire. And her recording of that was justly famous because of how she dealt with the difficulty of it.
Mm-hmm.
Adele's Laughing Song was another one that she was very fond of doing. And
yeah, she fancied herself a coloratura, it seems.
She fancied herself a coloratura, which she may have been in range, but certainly not in any other way.
Right.
And she was also rather old to be doing these things. Now,
right.
You know, in the world of opera,
divas
sometimes perform roles that they are well too long in the tooth to perform.
Mm-hmm.
But she was performing Adele's Laughing Song well into her 70s.
Mm.
And, you know, Adele's a sprightly little maid, and Florence was a big, kind of formidable woman.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of ridiculous watching her do some of that stuff. But and the Bell Song from Lakmé and a number of other things.
She sold out Carnegie Hall.
The Carnegie Hall thing was a huge deal because, you know, she had been performing all of these kind of private concerts, mostly in the ballroom of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. But eventually her fame got to the point where the promoters at Carnegie Hall wanted her to do a concert there for a huge crowd. And it sold out almost immediately. The day of the concert, there were literally thousands of people on the street trying to get tickets to get in because so many people had heard about her. Some of the best-known people of the era, Cole Porter was there, Tallulah Bankhead was there. The story is that Tallulah Bankhead had to be carried out of her box because she got hysterical. I mean, the glitterati all showed up for this concert.
Mm.
And it was a huge success in some ways. In other ways, as the play posits, it was the first time that Florence had an idea or got the idea that maybe the people were not there to support her, but to laugh at her.
Mm.
And that was kind of a shattering revelation. And indeed, she did die a month later of a heart attack. And the conjecture, you know, some people conjecture that she died of a broken heart. The play conjectures that that's not what happened at all, that she was resilient enough to bounce back from kind of the negative press that she got and some of the weird audience responses that she got, and she was ready to go on again, but she was just struck down. So, it, you know, we don't really know exactly what happened, but it was a watershed experience for her, certainly, and it was mm-hmm. kind of a minor cultural revolution, too.
How do you find an actress to play this role?
Oh, my God. Well, we ended up at Northlight looking at a lot of actresses who had played the role already, because the show has been done at a number of theaters around the country in the last few years. And so I saw a number of people who hadn't played the role before, but it's very difficult to find somebody who can act the role, can sing the opera stuff, and can sing badly convincingly. You
That's so really hard,
great.
Especially for a singer to sing badly is like the most...
Oh, it's very, very, very difficult.
Very difficult.
So we ended up seeing a number of people who had played the role before in other productions. And one of those was a woman named Neva Ray Powers, who had played this at St. Louis Rep and in Cincinnati and a couple of other places, I think. And she actually has family in South Bend. So this summer when she was visiting her family, she came up and auditioned for me, and I just fell in love with her. Because she's just this wonderful, delightful spirit. She is a wonderful musician, so she can handle all the rigors of the role. And there is, you know, without giving anything away, there are points in the evening where we hear what Florence would have sounded like had she been good. And so you have to have that part, too.
Mm-hmm.
And Neva Ray was just perfect. So we got her for this. And then an actor named Mark Anders, who is based in Seattle, has performed several times at Northlight and other things. And B.J. Jones, the artistic director, they recommended him to me. And I saw him audition, and he was a kind of perfect counterpoint for Neva Ray. So they're doing wonderful things together.
Well, it's a show that I hope a lot of people can get out to see. I'm really, and I know you'd have to be in the Chicago area, so I know those of you who listen from other countries and around the U.S. won't get to see this, but I do hope it encourages you to seek out her music and her story, because she's such a fascinating figure in Americana.
She really is. It's been wonderful just reading about her and seeing stuff about her, because I really didn't know much about her before this, and she's a fascinating woman.
Yeah, and I venture to say that a film will be made about her at some point. I kind of can't believe one hasn't been made, but for the time being, you can explore her on the web. We'll try to link a couple of experiences of her that you can see in our show notes, and also information on how, if you're in the Chicago area or you can get to Chicago, throughout the holidays, the show will be playing. So many of you travel here for the holiday season if you don't live here. Souvenir is playing November 12th through December 20th at Northlight Theater. That's in Skokie, Illinois, which is essentially Chicago, just up Skokie Boulevard, 9501 Skokie Boulevard in Skokie. For tickets and information, you can visit northlight.org. And we will have that linked as well so you can purchase tickets. Steve, thank you so much for bringing Florence Foster Jenkins to our QueerCast listeners today.
My great pleasure, and I hope everybody can come see the show. I think it's going to be great.
Got something to say? Call us today, 312-21-BE-GAY. So, Stephen, thanks for being on with me today. I feel like we just get a little bit of a hiccup before we head into the holidays with you, and your life goes cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
Oh, it's crazy. And it's been crazy. It's been crazy for a while anyway.
Yeah.
You know, just because of, you know, doing crazy musicals in 5 minutes and all that kind of good stuff. It's been nuts.
Yeah, you were celebrating the Hallowed Eve with the Porchlight Musical Theater.
Oh, I was. And I mean, I literally had the worst, one of those moments on stage where you go, this didn't just happen. Oh, yeah, it did.
Oh, no.
You know, it did. I literally forgot the entire verse of a song. The entire verse.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah. It was a very tricky little song, and I was really worried, because I landed it all fine. It was fine, but the whole show, but I was really worried about the second verse. So I went over the second verse about 150 times this one night, when the composer, of course, is coming that night, one of the composers.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked right up and started singing. It's like, I don't know this verse. I have no idea how it kicks off, and if I couldn't kick it off, I couldn't sing it.
Oh.
And so I, of course, am so used to singing by myself in cabaret and stuff. I just screamed stop. in a musical. And I turned around, and the look of absolute terror on every actor's face was like, crazy, crazy. I go to the guy playing the piano, musical director Eugene, ask him what the lyric is. He has no idea. He can't even find it, even though the book is in front of him. Crazy. We go back, we jump in again. I have no idea what it is again. I kind of grunted at the audience back and forth until that verse was over, and then I jumped in and I was fine. It was crazy.
Isn't that terrifying? I don't know. I'm trying to think if I've ever gone up on stage. I've had those moments where I think I'm going to go up, and then it comes to me. I'm trying to remember if I've had one of those, but it's truly a terrifying moment.
Well, one of the girls, because it's been horrible here in town with the illnesses in Chicago cast.
Right.
I mean, what have you? People were just not able to perform. And one of the girls, she just started crying backstage. She could not produce sound. It was going to be horrible, and she was very upset with herself. And she's just crying. I'm like, honey, it's just a show. Like, you know,
yep.
As my advisor in college said, what Mother Teresa does is important, and we do skits.
Yep.
Calm down. And the minute I went up and screwed everything up, she came up to me and she went, I know this is really bad, but I was so happy that you had done that. She's like, I know that's mean, but that really made me very happy because I thought, I can do anything now.
Yeah.
He's the fuck up. You know, it was bad.
You're like, I'm taking the fall for you and it's okay.
I've taken it, yes. But it was very fun. You know, I think I'm the guy to have that happen to because I could care less.
Yeah.
Let it go.
We do skits, but we change lives, just like Florence Foster Jenkins.
We change lives. One horrific person who's not got a call at a time.
Yep.
You know, here we go.
Hey, Florence did it. Why not you? Why not you? Stephen, we will talk to you here very soon again, probably right after the Thanksgiving holiday. But
yeehaw.
Thanks for being on with us. And everybody, we're going to be talking next week. We have not heard from Toronto in so long. Deb Pierce on the show. So everybody, have a good one. Thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. This program is brought to you in part by Broadway in Chicago. For the hottest tickets in town, visit BroadwayInChicago.com. And American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow. Special thanks to our Queercast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueercast.com and iTunes. The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast. Queer and now.